Oh, hey, Kate.
What would you do for a Klondike bar?
I honestly didn't know where you were going with that one. There was like so much possibility in the pause.
Yeah.
And then you just slid right into, just took a little left turn.
I
And what would you do for a Klondike bar?
There's very little I wouldn't do. Wrote that was one of my first published poems was about it.
Did they steal that from you for the advertisement of a Klondike bar? Did they lift your poetry?
No, my poetry was a direct reference to a poem, Klondike Bar. See if I can find it and make you listen. So, life is hard, suffering is inevitable. How are we doing? You there? I can't hear you. I just hear
I'm here.
I just didn't hear uproarious laughter. Fine.
You find the poem? Are you gracing us
Oh,
with a
no, yeah,
reading?
I'm still gonna f find it. Oh. Oh my God, that's it. It was my first published poem. Was one of them. Okay, it's called Priority. This is how we know it's gonna be a good one. Priority. And then you thought, finally, I can just eat some ice cream in peace. Although trying to hold the spoon is difficult when you're bleeding all over your hands and your ankles are still tied together. But the man and his wife have left you to your own devices for at least a few godly hours. And that is your reward for all the days, maybe even weeks of good behavior. And with your chafed wrists, you can pry open the freezer or the front door. At least you know what's behind one of them. And so you set about breaking the padlock on the freezer door with the man's hammer he left in the basement right next to your cot. You swing at the thing, and it breaks on the first try. And when the icy smoke spills from that sacred box, you can see the Kelly green of the Thin Mints, purchased from roving gypsies months ago, and the silvery sheen of the cubic six-pack. What wouldn't you do for a Klondike bar? There is very little you would not do for a Klondike bar. So, that's a poem about a girl who's locked in a basement, just to be clear. A girl is locked in the basement by a husband and wife, and she gets out and realizes she could run out the front door or she could break the freezer and get the Klondike bar, and she chooses the Klondike bar.
It's dark.
Yeah. Actually not bad. I'm not like embarrassed of that.
Do you read old stuff where you're like, ooh?
Yes, I for sure do. I was actually thinking about that last night. I have a collection out there, and there was one where I was in a really hard place in my life, just terrible, and I had some unresolved feelings about some childhood stuff, and I wrote pretty brutally and pretty unveiled about people that, I have now resolved and repaired relationships with. And, while I don't say them by name, it's not like impossible to figure out who they are.
Yeah.
And I cringe over that because mostly at the time I didn't see any hope for repair. And the art or the poem or whatever wanted to come out bad enough that I let it. And then I let it get published and I let people read it. And now, 15, 20 years later, I feel different about the person, and I But I try to like allow mediocre poetry that I no longer align with to exist, because for a period of time that was art and that was true. And you know, I think if every artist lived in fear of putting out something embarrassing, we'd have a lot less art floating around out there. You know, there are poets far more widely read and celebrated that have put out things that are deeply painfully embarrassing for them, and you know, they live with that. And some people would probably be like, yeah, but why are they embarrassed? That was their best work. And they'd be like, yeah, no, I don't see it that way.
Yeah.
I recognize that my work from when I was younger was toothier. It was sharper and it was angrier. I don't know that it was better. I think it was fueled from a different place. Mm-hmm. But I have had just a pretty radical shift around how I think about poetry and the process of getting work published and who the audience is. And one of my main issues with all of it, and I'm starting to feel this way about yoga too, is that you get really good, not necessarily at the craft, but you get really good at publishing the work you've done. And I watch colleagues that have basically just become professional, like churners, like, you know, mm-hmm. it's like this hungry grab for who can stay in the game the longest and get published and then get nominated for awards. And then they are on awards committee picking out the next round. And there is something deeply incestual about it. And I was starting to like achieve a little bit of traction and more success and pick up, you know, more publications, nothing major. And then I was like, and then what?
Yeah.
Then you get picked up by like a cool small independent press, and who reads it? You know? Yeah. A couple other people that got their MFAs, a couple other people that are dedicating their lives to getting their work published and read by few. And I think I have an anger a little bit, not about the craft or the art of poetry, but about the industry around it and the inaccessibility still of access to the art, access to understanding the art. And then it's just like for the select few. And it's so much of that is true of yoga. Like, you know, you just become really good at picking up classes and getting people to come to them. But then you stop and you look and you say, okay, but who's here and who's not here? And especially when we think about, okay, are, you know, people just going on because it's like this fight to the middle. You know, and everybody wants to do the teacher training, although I'm seeing a slowing sort of vibe around that. And, you know, it's sort of the same thing with poetry. Like a lot of people are reading poetry books and then they're like, okay, now I'm going to do mine. And it's like, there's no sense of like having something just exist to exist well.
Yeah.
To be enjoyed of its own accord. And that doesn't mean I want to quit teaching yoga. It doesn't mean I want to quit writing. I just am really questioning the avenues with which I pursue them.
Yeah. Well, it is. I was going to say, to the poetry point, I feel like there is something really distinct in my choice when I was younger to write music that never had any lyrics, or at least lyrics of my own. And it chose a fairly non-linguistic form. I don't know that that's really accurate, because jazz has a linguistics all its own. It's just not, you know. But I still have moments when I like will hear something that I wrote where I'm like, ooh, that wasn't
that
so
was
great.
Obvious. My main thing is like, ooh, that was obvious. That's like the main critique.
Yeah. For me, it's actually listening back and be like, that's just like density for the sake of densities. Like how many things can I cram into this one? this one. How many things can I cram into this one piece? How many different time signatures? How many different chords, how many different modes, how many
Look at all the things I know. Look at them. They're all here.
But I do, like, I think there is something shifting in terms of like, one thing I see is that people, most of the discussion that I see going around in the yoga space is more like, it actually feels to me that it sidesteps the actual thing that people are doing on the yoga mat. It's about all of the implications of doing the thing on the yoga mat in society, which is great because that conversation was not had for a very long time. But it still feels to me very, there's a lot of like, yoga should be this way, yoga should be that way, yoga should, you know, this is this kind of a practice. But then if you actually turn around, and I've said this a million times before, if you turn around to someone and say, well, how did you practice this morning? Or how did you, like, what is your practice? Like, what do you actually, like, what is the, how do you engage with this in a personal way? That the answers are fairly, I actually find that it's like a threatening conversation to folks.
Interesting. That's a good word.
Because
because the answer is always going to be, well, I put on an Annie Lennox album and I roll around and do a quad stretch and a little back bend, and then I fill the dishwasher, and then I head back to the mat, and I work through that sequence somebody else did that felt kind of good, and I scribble it down. Maybe I'll use it for class, and then extended shavasana. That's, by the way, that is not meant to be like what I do. What I do is far less.
No, you involved. Don't use any Lennox. You.
Beep, 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 beep. Ah.
Kate just puts Walking on Broken Glass on a loop and just
me and my childhood best friend Jen Stanley used to go into her mother's sewing room and blast Walking on Broken Glass, and Jen used to try to teach me how to dance. She was like, Katie, we're going to teach you how to dance. And I was like, okay. And then we would go into her bedroom and kiss the poster on her wall of, what was it, Donnie from New Kids on the Block. I feel like that's,
sure, why not? Right.
Anyways, I love that song though, Walking on Broken Glass.
It's a great song.
And if you're trying to put me down. Anyways. Yeah, I don't think anybody's doing shit. And that's okay.
It is okay. I think the interesting thing though is, what I think is a, and has been for quite some time, the growing chasm between what people actually engage in as practice and the product that is meant to be presented in the studio space, virtual or physical.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, like I've spoken, you know, kind of, I don't think you'd like to be identified, but I've spoken with very well-known teachers who basically, like, you know, their main thing is like lifting weights, and then they do a little bit of asana now and again, and then they meditate. But they're still out there teaching whatever the like form is that they learned, and I'm always like, I mean, I could see an argument for that.
I mean, does a baker who got really good at sourdough have to wake up every morning and make and eat sourdough? Are they allowed to just teach it and no longer consume it?
Sure, but I don't know that there's anything fundamentally wrong with sourdough, where some of the forms...
Oh, there might be.
We're going to have a Me Too moment with sourdough.
No. No, but like, okay, we'll think about this. So like a baker.
Okay.
I mean, nobody's going to argue that it's probably, maybe not, in the body's best interest
to eat sourdough.
Consume, like, cupcakes every day. And what if you are absolutely brilliant cupcake maker and people come to you because they want to know how to make cupcakes? And someday you're like, look, I am gluten intolerant and, you know, I have diabetes. And now, like, these are the, you know, in this theoretical situation, this is what's happening. Like, I eat avocado and protein. And I steer away from the cupcakes, but every day I go in and I teach people who want to know how to make cupcakes, how to make cupcakes.
I think the difference is that we're talking about a cupcake and not some transcendental, transformational.
Don't you put down the transformative possibility of baked goods. I feel a little condescended here because truly, isn't that interesting? What you've done is said, no, 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 there is no sacred there. There is no holiness imbued in the act of the transubstantiation of one's energetic ideals into a baked good. It's there. God is there. Split a rock. I am there. I am who am. Not that. Tatvamashi. Let's. You want me to get, I'm just saying, the cupcake is the practice. Oh, that's the title.
The cupcake is the practice. Yes, it's very Zen. I think you could develop a whole new class where you just, you get, I can see it now. You get everybody in the room at, in the basement at Down Under Yoga, and you get them totally spaced out in yoga nidra, and then you coax them off the floor and you walk them across the street
to Tate Bakery
and you get them a cupcake.
Or better yet, hear me out, yoga nidra, I have brought in 3 dozen of those very soft sugar cookies with the frosting on top that come out every season. Yeah. And they're just terrible, terrible. They're like cocaine and heroin in like a soft kiss from St. Peter. And they're just absolute pure opium. And I just put one of those on everyone's mat. No. So... No, but in all seriousness.
Oh, I was thinking more you were always going to have one less cookie than there are people in the classroom, and you were just going to put them up at the front of the room.
And we'll just call it like eating disorder 101.
Yeah.
And like every class, I'm like mysteriously 2 pounds heavier. We're already doing that experiment, Ryan. No. Better yet, it's me at the front of the class with a bag of Cheetos, just eat, like just eating while talking. Yeah, we're pretty much there as well.
Do you use it? You should get a little like cute tong, pair of tongs to eat the Cheetos with.
Yeah, and you know what that would do, Ryan? You know what that would do? It would slow me down. And I don't appreciate that because so much of Cheeto consumption is really about velocity.
The speed, velocity, not even speed, the velocity with which the Cheeto.
Yeah. And it's about like it's about the volume in between the back molars and how quickly it can just morph into that cornmeal pate that hugs the mouth.
Sweet embrace.
The sweet embrace of the cornmeal pate. Anyways, what were we talking about? Oh, yeah, cupcakes. So, I mean, I think the argument is cupcakes are not meant to be consumed every day. But who says? And you know what? Maybe yoga is not meant to be done every day.
Or maybe asana is not meant to be done.
Ha-ha, yes. Every day.
Or maybe, to be more specific, a highly systematized series of postures done repetitively. And I don't like, you know, there's value to form, right? Like, I am happy that there is maybe one day a year where I get on my mat and go, I'm going to do what is my version, let me put it this way. I'm going to take primary series, my understanding of primary series, and do it in a way that is beneficial to me without necessarily all of the strictures and there's some Lotus stuff that gets completely thrown out the door. But like, I am grateful to have had an experience of that form, and I'm grateful to have an experience of the Iyengar form, in even though it's less sort of pose by pose broken out. And to go even sort of less lineage than that, it's helpful to have like I tell people this all the time when they ask me about sequences in the back of books for like yoga for this or yoga for that. And I'm like, well, in most of those books, that sequence clearly worked for somebody. So like, use it as a jumping off point, but don't use it as a prescriptive template. You know what I mean? Like, but if I see a sequence in the back of the book, a book of a teacher who I generally trust, and it's meant to address X or Y, then yeah, it might be a curious experiment to go, okay, here's a hypothesis, here's a loose frame of a sequence, or at least just a starting point, which is what those things often are. And then your own intelligence kind of takes over and you start to do what is helpful. But, you know, to have those references as a jumping off point is really useful. It's just, I don't know, if the practice, quote unquote, is just getting on your mat and going through asana, then it's kind of hard to take that bigger view of what the possibility is. And if you are dependent on cupcakes for a living, it can be very difficult to say, I don't really like cupcakes anymore.
Yeah, and you can still be a good teacher, though. You can still be a good...
Oh, totally. But I think there's an honesty there, though. To be a good teacher and be able to say, this was helpful for me, and it is no longer helpful for me, but I still think it's a valuable thing to teach to people. But it is not, in fact, what I practice because of aging, injury, you know, whatever, then, you know, I feel like to be honest and upfront about that is fine. If someone And for there to be things that you also that you practice that you don't teach to people. I practice headstand. It's very rare that I teach it to folks. And it's probably if I had never learned it, I probably would have a perfectly fine and happy yoga practice. If it was never emphasized that that was something that I should do.
Yeah, I mean, I think about how sort of the implication that you practice isn't real. You're not a teacher, your practice isn't real and full until you can do an inversion on your head, one on your hands, one on your forearms, and
One
wheel.
and wheel.
Wheel and split.
Oh, yeah.
Feel like the implication is like, yeah, once you've got all those things, you're allowed to call yourself a teacher. And also, you have a real practice now. And it's just, it's so ableist. Like, I see it now so clearly. And you know, there was a period of time where I could do many of those things, not never all. But I always felt less than. And I think about like those teacher trainings perpetuating that, and they still do. And
Oh yeah, they absolutely still do.
it's so behind and backward and sluggish, and I'm in quite frankly harmful. And it's like do a workshop for that, you know, have a teacher training. You know, maybe that introduces those concepts, but if you really want to deep dive on them, like have that be a continuing ed. It's just like not a primary skill that, you know, and even like having conversations with different people in TT, and the primary concern is am I allowed to be here? I can't do X. And it's like, I don't know, am I allowed to be here? I can't do X either. Like, yeah, I don't know.
But it's also There also is something where it's like beyond the poses, we've set up this system where your practice isn't real until you've done the teacher training.
Yeah.
Because we put, well, what's funny nowadays is like it used to be that I think for a while is like we put this all of the content into this $3,000 to $5,000 package that everyone was making a lot of money on, and like if you really wanted to learn the things, like you had to go here. But now it's sort of like actually there's not much content going on in teacher trainings. It's mostly just a hodgepodge of bullshit. And I know because I write curriculum for the hodgepodges of bullshit. The information is really actually kind of all out there.
Yeah, but then we don't have the Yoga Alliance to tell me that.
You've done a thing.
Yeah, it's not real until daddy comes in and slaps you on the ass and says, good job, kiddo.
Yeah. Because if you really like wanted
Sorry,
to
that
you
was.
find a teacher you love, take their classes, ask lots of questions. You want the philosophy thing. Is it yogic studies or yoga studies, the Seth Powell? There's plenty of courses out there that can teach you all of the teach you all of the as deep down the philosophical well as you want to go, they exist out there. When you are taking with a teacher and you're finding they don't have the answers to XYZ question that you are asking, then go ask them if there's someone who's maybe more has more of a specialty in what you're asking for. And just like it you're right, there is this feeling of like Yoga Alliance being the and the industry. Like I don't actually think it's just Yoga Alliance. It's everyone has a stake in these things being successful and continuing to be the model. But I don't necessarily know that it's how you It's how you learn to do the performance of being a teacher. But I don't know that it's how you learn. I'm, you know, obviously I can't speak for everyone's experience, but it certainly wasn't how I learned to practice. Did I learn some interesting things in formal trainings? Well, yeah.
I don't know. I didn't learn to practice truly until I had severe injuries.
Yeah.
And then the practice became something else. I became an active participant in the authorship of the practice and the purpose of it, rather than echoing or mirroring something I thought I was supposed to
do.
Be doing to have a practice. I just, you know, the world is on fire and we have such bigger fish to fry than, and it, you know, to come full circle back to the poetry thing, I think about somebody I graduated with who just a really, really gifted writer and, you know, worked mostly in poetry and then, you know, had a moment where, you know, she writes all kinds of stuff, but, you know, her first big publishing deal was actually her memoir. And I think it was because there's just like, I see a lot of poets making, you know, the shift to journalism or nonfiction because there's like a sense of urgency right now in the world where I am. And to liken it to yoga, it's like, what do you need from the practice to be a good, kind person that is going to survive? What do you need for your survival?
Yeah.
What do you need to be okay? And not what do you need to get to series fucking three? Fuck you. Cool. Glad you got a hobby. Glad you got a hobby that, you know, that works out for you on Instagram. That's super cool. But like, I'm just not interested. Like, I'm much more interested in like, okay, are you out there doing meaningful work in the world? Can yoga help you keep doing that work in the world?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about yoga in that context. And with writing, it's like, okay, you've got a beautiful sense of narrative and a lovely vocabulary and a more interesting ability to synthesize those words and weave them together. Now don't go pouring that all into poetry where it will hide and not be seen or of use. Or of less use. I mean, people see it, you know, but like, you know, instead put it in a format where it can be of more immediate use to more people and more accessible. Because to me, there's just such an urgency right now. The world is on fire. And I have a flamboyant disgust for things that are not addressing urgent needs of other humans. So stop fucking selling me clothes. Stop selling me shit.
You will buy it.
Thank you. You just saved me from getting real weird. I'm gonna buy it, you asshole. I'm gonna buy it, but B, you're better than that.
Yeah.
Or maybe you're not. I don't know. What the fuck am I to say? Maybe you are just fucking Barbie girl in a Barbie world selling your fucking clothes. Stop it. Do better. Go fucking fight your racist family on social media. Try. Do something. I don't know what it is. I don't know. I'm well, pulled up in it.
And that's the thing is, like, the performance of Instagram, Facebook, whatever, like, there's all the potential for that to be valuable in getting the word out. And I also believe, like, for many of us, I'm myself included, it is such a energetic and boundary blurring time suck for me to engage in that world. Even just posting sometimes feels that way. And so, you know, when I see like people being like, you know, all these people being silent out there, and I'm just like, well, speech doesn't just happen on Instagram, folks. Like,
yeah, but for the people who it does, so here's my thing, because I shared something that was like, it was like, if you're a fucking influencer on here and you're being silent, fuck you.
Yeah.
So if you are, if your work is already being vocal on social media and you're silent about it, that's fucking weird. Yeah. Is it a call to action to people who are like not using social media that way to then use it that way? Not necessarily.
Well, and the thing that is always very confusing to me about the use of social media is it is both a really potent and potential tool for communication and social change, and everyone's selling something. Everyone's selling something. Because everyone has to sell something, because it's fucking capitalism and we all gotta put food on our tables. So like that weird convergence is just very, like, I'm always so cognizant of it when I am engaging with those platforms, that like, yes, good work can be done here and everyone's selling something, whether it's a direct sell or whether it's indirect, I guess is the word I'm looking for. That there's always something, and I'm not saying that that's necessarily a bad thing. I buy things. I choose to support the people that I choose to support, but I'm try to be very cognizant of the fact that this thing is designed to sell me stuff, and the fact that we're able to use it in a positive way is great. But fundamentally, the whole thing is designed to sell me stuff.
Sell me better stuff.
Kate just wants better stuff, everybody. So if you could just sell Kate better stuff. I would like better stuff, too, though. That would be nice.
Yeah.
And to be fair, I am also doing the selling. Like, I also have to make a living. So, like,
I'm not entirely sure what I'm selling. I got to be completely honest with you. I don't know. I know you're right. I'm selling something. I have classes people can attend. But I don't necessarily, like, want people to come.
You hear that, everyone? Kate requests that you do not come to her classes anymore.
No. I like the people that come. You know what it is?
People that come, just don't anyone else come.
I like that people come and I'm not fucking shoving shit down their throats. Yeah. I don't want to be like, come to my class. I'm just not interested in that. I don't think it's healthy for me or for people. If they find my class, if it works with their schedule, if they enjoy it, that's awesome. I don't take it personally when somebody comes to my class like every day for a year and then disappears. It's just not my business. Like, that happens. All of it happens to everybody all the time. So I try to be very detached from it. I don't think I'm using social media as a vehicle to get folks into my class. But I mean, probably this is the most selling I'm doing, is like me sitting here with you speaking freely about how I feel about things tends to be a better magnet.
We've already, to be fair, we've said this. Yeah, I'm sure you could go back to the early episodes. Like, we did have a discussion early on. It's like, this is essentially our version of getting half naked and selling our classes.
Look at this stuff, isn't it neat? Wouldn't you think, my
lidocaine is not gonna cut it.
Is that the start of a new poem? That's a great first line of a new poem.
It really is. Lidocaine is not gonna cut it. We lost a chicken.
Second line. This is, keep going. This is a freewheeling. Here we go. Here we go. Lidocaine is not enough. Not gonna cut it. We lost a chicken.
It wasn't her fault. It wasn't the dog's fault either. It was just a few feathers at first. But it was the fear. The fear must have been immeasurable. She henned down. Expanded herself as large as her universe would allow. Her feathers, instruments of deception. New line, a trembling. In truth, it wasn't the dog taking a few feathers. It was the fear of it happening again. And so she made her way under the coop. Scratched up some extra free dirt. Saved us the trouble of burying herself. Closed her eyes and said, enough. Mic drop, we're out. Anyways, so we lost her, and we lost her to fear, really. She was okay. The dog just nipped and got a few tails out of her butt. And the poor thing, we did our best. There was no blood. There was no... She was terrified for the next week or so. She just wasn't the same. And I think it was the stress. I honestly think I watched a bird die of PTSD. And let that be a fucking lesson. We were really lucky, all of our, from early chickdom, they all survived. We didn't think they all would. And, she's in the garden now, returning back to source. But fear is more dangerous than the dog tooth, you know? How do we get here? I feel like I've gained 10 pounds on the course of this call. Do you see this? I feel like I'm like, this is the least flattering angle. There's nothing wrong with weight gain. Let's start that conversation. So lidocaine's not going to cut it. There's more urgent shit. Make the most of your life. It's not too late. Whatever it is, it's not too fucking late. If you woke up this morning, the amount of people that live in fear of making changes, the amount of people that live in fear that their life is somehow already over is breathtaking and astounding to me. I'm all fucked up in all kinds of ways. I know that. But when you scratch the surface of most people, there is such a degree of terror this idea that your life ends when you're out of college or grad school and you better fucking buckle down and keep doing it. Like the fear of like making radical reinventions of your life or doing hard things or brave things or whatever, or letting yourself love what you fucking love or who you love or any of it. Like I'm really tuned in to the terror, the collective terror that people are just walking around with. And then I think, oh, but we could be having such fun.
Such fun. Yeah.
If you could send me that chicken poem, that would be great.
I will. I'm going to put it in the show notes for everybody. That's just actually, that's just going to be the description of the episode. It's just that poem.
I thought it was the cupcake.
Well, we can have both.
Okay, that makes me feel better. Are you okay? Are you okay?
Yeah.
You do seem okay.
I'm doing okay. It's really, really lovely to be back working with folks in a room. It's really lovely.
Is it?
I mean, we're talking about one other human at a time. but it's really nice. Yeah, I don't know. And I
send me out on a happy note.
Oh, I was just, I don't know if this is a happy note, but I was going to mention that I've had just like a series of conversations with different teachers and studio owners and about to be studio owners and you know, all of this thing. And I'm really struck by how everyone is trying to rationalize that their choice is going to be the one that comes out on top post-pandemic, their choice to be fully online or really, really try to be back in person all the time. And it's like you can hear them like self-convincing that like this is going to be the way forward. And it's like, first of all, none of us can predict the way forward. And whether it's going back in person or being fully online, going back to a studio, going entirely out on your own, being in a church basement, teaching out of your garage, like, I don't know, whatever the fuck it is, like, just don't go back to the way it was. Because the way it was had some serious fucking flaws. Just take the time. Probably we're not going to be anywhere near back to normal, large air quotes, until at least September. So really think about it. Like, now's your time to change shit. Change shit. And do what you want. Do what you think is valuable. If you don't think online is valuable, don't do online. If you don't like being in rooms with people, then be an online yoga teacher. there will be folks who are interested in both. And I just think it's pointless to try and game this out, this post-pandemic yoga world, in any way other than like, what do I think is valuable and what do I want to do with my time and my skills and my resources?
Thank you. That's the measured way of saying it.
What's the unmeasured way of saying it?
The world is on fire. Go do be. Doobie doobie doo.
Doobie doobie doo.
And back to jazz.
And back to jazz. Well, right, this has been unrolled.
Yes, it has.
Most certainly has. I feel like I was going to have some sort of administrative announcement, but I don't, because I can't think of anything.
I love you, Steve Buscemi.
To Steve.
to Steve.
Bye. Bye. An odd interval that we just chose.
It's kind of